UK Wine Show, show number 141. Matthew Dickinson on France. On this week's wine show, we're talking with Matthew Dickinson from Terry's, the biggest importer of French wine into the UK. We talked to him about the future of France.
And in the news, wine scientists discover chemical fingerprint, Beaujolais producers on trial, and Thresher's future in doubt.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 141 for the 30th of January 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Matthew Dickinson. Matthew is the commercial director at Terry's Wine Services, the UK's largest importer of French wines, and we talk with Matthew about the future of France. In the spotlight, we continue looking at the science of wine tasting. This week, we're trying to understand how our noses work. And this week's quote, not exactly a wine quote this week, but still, I think it's a great one. I like to have a martini. Two at the most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under the host. Who said that? Clues throughout the show, answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. First this week, 53 producers in Beaujolais in France were on trial for illegally adding sugar to their wines. The process of adding sugar to wine, known as chaptalisation, is allowed in France, provided producers don't raise the alcohol level by above 2 degrees. But due to poor weather in 2004, the Beaujolais producers sought official approval to add more sugar to allow them to raise the alcohol by 2.5 degrees. They went ahead with the chaptalisation process while awaiting approval, which was subsequently denied. The court will also examine how producers obtain their sugar, with four supermarkets and four suppliers also on trial for illegally buying and selling about 600 tonnes of sugar between 2004 and 2007.
Now, there have been calls for fines of up to 5,000 euros for the prosecutor, but to me, that's a joke. 5,000 euros is nothing for a wholeheartedly and knowingly breaking the law. What I don't understand is how and why they needed to add sugar in 2005, which was considered one of the great vintages. This is not a minor rule breaking, but a systemic criminal action. They claim to be following the rules, and according to the news article, they thought the rules were going to be changed to allow them to add the sugar. But the question is, why was there no documentation? The only record were the trucks who delivered the hundreds of tons of sugar. They didn't follow the basic rules of the appellation about recording the sugar into their wines as well. 5,000 euros by the prosecutor is a joke. According to the AFP, the French National Consumer Organization, the CLCV, is demanding fines of closer to 80,000 euros for offences, which deliberately fly in the face of regulation designed to protect the consumer. There's new technology coming along that's going to be able to fingerprint grapes. What's going on there, Jane?
Yes, well, two forensic scientists at the University of Western Australia have found a way to prove the origin of wine chemically. Alex Martin and John Watling used mass spectrometry to determine the chemical composition or fingerprint of 400 wines from around Australia. The fingerprint is made up of over 60 trace elements, which depend mainly on the soil composition of the region and the grape variety. They found that wines made from one grape variety in one region have similar chemical fingerprints and are quite different to those of the same grape variety in other regions. They're now building up a database of wines from around the world, which could help confirm the identity of a wine by comparing its fingerprint to those in the database.
Let's get back to the UK, though. How's the recession biting, Jane?
Well, things aren't looking so great for off-licence chain Thresher's. After it was revealed that 100 stores have been closed by the owner First Quench in the last 6 months. It's reported that further unprofitable shops could close unless First Quench can negotiate a reduction in rents and a change in terms with the landlords. According to one landlord, First Quench are offering to buy their way out of leases, and many landlords are accepting the offer, meaning that many more stores will close. First Quench has around 1,500 stores across the UK and also operates as Wine Rack, The Local and Haddo's in Scotland. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
First Quench / Thresher's, they're not the only people suffering. Anglo Overseas, one of the big providers of logistics for the wine trade in the UK, went into administration this week. Oddbins are going to be decreasing the hours of some of their staff as well. Although Oddbins did stress they weren't going to be making anybody redundant. That ends the news this week. Next up, we're going to be looking at the spotlight. We're looking this week at the nose and the science of smelling. Our noses are amazing machines. They can detect up to 10,000 different aromas, or more precisely, they're called odours. An odour is a chemical that is evaporated into the air and is generally very low in concentration. They travel in the air through to our noses, and they can reach there either through smelling, or if you're eating, the vapours travel down your throat and up into your nose through the back. In fact, most of the flavour we taste is actually coming from our nose, not our mouth, which, as we said last week, can only detect sweet, sour, bitter, salt, umami, and heat from alcohol. It may seem strange that some food can taste different than they smell, but this is because once wine or food is entered the mouth, the temperature of the mouth changes the wine and changes the compounds that are vaporized, changing the odor. Once the odor has reached our nose, it's detected by the olfactory receptor neurons that transform the odor into electrical current. The odor receptor neurons is a gene protein coupled receptor and works in a similar way to the G protein coupled receptors in our mouth that detect sweet, umami, and bitterness. The olfactory sensory neurons exist in a layer of tissue known as the olfactory epithelium. The epithelium is a tissue composed of cells that line the cavities and surfaces and structures throughout the body. The more olfactory epithelium you have, the higher the sensitivity and the number of olfactory receptors in your nose. Olfactory sensory neurons pass the electricity activity to the olfactory bulb in the brain through nerve fibers. Once the electrical signals reach the olfactory bulb, which is part of the brain, it processes the smells and sends signals to other parts of the body. Smelling is made up of two parts, sensing the odor and responding to it. For example, if you smell something delicious to eat, your body receives the aroma into your brain and you know about it, but you're also likely to start producing saliva because of that, hence receiving the smell and then responding to them. How sensitive you are to a particular smell varies between humans and is controlled by the physical construction of your nose and how you've trained your brain. Humans have about 10 centimeters squared of olfactory epithelium, whereas dogs have 170 centimeters. A dog's olfactory epithelium is also considerably more dense, with hundreds more receptors per square centimeters. So no matter how sensitive you are, you're never going to outsmell a dog. You can train your brain to be more precise in identifying different aromas, and aroma kits are a great way of training your nose to discriminate between different aromas. But whether you detect them in the first place is based on your physical limitations. The threshold that you detect components varies from person to person and is usually measured in parts per million, with some aromas people are quite sensitive to, such as cork taint. The total number of G protein coupled receptors in our genome is thought to be around 350 in total, and they're shared throughout the body. But we can detect about 10,000 different aromas. How can this be? It's because it's not a one-to-one relationship. A compound may trigger multiple receptors to fire. It's then up to our brain, and more precisely, the olfactory bulb, to process this information and create the senses and aromas. This may be why two people can smell the same thing and think there's two different aromas. But I suspect it's more to do with a lack of training in the nose. In many animals, there's a second olfactory system known as the accessory olfactory system, and that's used to detect chemical signals between species. These are more commonly known as pheromones, and they play no part in wine tasting. And sadly for humans, it would appear that the accessory olfactory system no longer works. It is known to form in the womb, but is thought not to fully develop. Although some scientists do believe that pheromones are responsible, for example, for women's menstrual cycles coming into sync if they spend time together. It's not just the accessory olfactory system. Human sense of smell is thought to have deteriorated during human evolution, with Neanderthals having larger noses and more epithelium, meaning more sensitive noses. That ends this week's look at the spotlight and our first cut through. Over the last couple of months, we've gone all the way from looking at soils, right through to tasting and smelling the wine. Next week, I have got a book review, and it's a book you probably haven't heard of before, but it is a really good book. Teach Yourself Wine. We'll talk about that next week in the Spotlight. But how are you getting on with the quote? I like to have a martini, two at the most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under the host. I do like that quote, even though it's not really a wine quote. It was said by a female American writer who grew up in New York but moved to California. She was said to be witty, self-destructive, and incredibly influential, writing for Vogue, Condé Nast, and Vanity Fair. In 1934, she moved to Hollywood and worked as a screenwriter and picked up two Academy Award nominations. Any ideas who she is? I'll give you the answer after the interview with Matthew Dickinson from Terry's Wine Services. We're going to be talking with him about France. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm here with Matthew Dickinson from Terry's. You guys are big importers into the UK.
That's right, Chris. We do about 65 million bottles into the UK currently. A lot of that is France. We're about 70% French wines. We've been around for about 30 years. Our founder, Thierry Caban, came to the UK in his youth and started working from the back of a crepe van, selling crepe to outside football matches, outside Chelsea crepe. Stadium. Pancakes, French pancakes.
Oh, yeah, great.
And he graduated from there to actually owning his own restaurant in the King's Road, which I believe is still there, called Thierry. It's no longer under his ownership, and it's not as great a restaurant as it used to be. And the restaurant was very famous in the 70s for basically being a celebrity hangout. And Thierry used to have a door policy, so he'd basically kind of pull back the shutter on the door, and if he didn't like your face, he didn't let you in. But celebrities like James Hunt, the racing driver, used to frequent it all the time, a lot of models, and it was very much the place to be. And Thierry was a great visionary guy, and he worked out in the 70s that actually he could do a better job importing wine for his own restaurant, which is what he started doing. And he came from the Loire Valley in France, and he just gave a couple of mates a call and said, look, you know, can we get a couple of pallets of wine in? And that's what he did. And the business kind of grew from there. And after a while, he was actually importing more wine to fellow restaurateurs around London than he, you know, doing more turnover than he was in his restaurant. So he said, well, maybe there's something in this. And he also spotted at the time an opportunity to import wine into the supermarkets. And this was, we're talking sort of early to mid-70s, really, when the concept of supermarket wine was pretty much non-existent. And so Thierry was part of that vanguard of getting wines out to the wider UK consumer. And grew the business alongside the supermarkets, who form a core part of our customer base today. So we're basically dealing with all the major retailers in the UK, and a number of pub chains, cash and carry groups, wholesalers, and that type of thing.
You're an importer, not a wholesaler, or would you class yourself?
No, I think to be specific, we're an importer, and we tend to deal with third parties. So we won't deal with individual restaurants or private individuals. We tend to deal with a wholesaler. We will sell to wholesalers.
I hadn't really heard much about Thierry's until recently.
Yeah, I mean, Thierry used to say that we were the biggest wine company you've never heard of. He sadly died in a car accident in September 2007, and then it gave the new owners of the business, who are the key directors of the business, an opportunity to look at how we do things. And one of the things that we decided is that we felt a little bit more profile would be good for us. And so, you know, we're not talking about consumer profile in the sense of putting our name all over bottles of wine, but we're talking in terms of, you know, just getting our name out and about in the trade and becoming famous for what we're good at, which is, you know, specializing in France. We're 70% French wines, but also very much a focus on great quality, great value, hero wine makers, which is very much part of our offer.
What do you mean by hero winemakers?
Well, we basically have a family of about 12 winemakers who we call our hero winemakers, and these are guys who are not just great at making wine, because there are a number of those who exist in many businesses around the world. But these are guys who are not just great at making wine, but they're also pioneers. They have great personalities, and they always challenge the way things are normally done, and they challenge the status quo, and they want to do things differently. And they're also, you know, they're big personalities, they're characters. So, for example, Dani de Wet in South Africa. who was the first guy to plant Chardonnay there. He's a very big guy, very larger than life. And he, you know, he's very much part of that. He's very involved in the South African wine industry. Obviously, he has a great estate of wines, of fantastic wines, but he's a great ambassador for South African wines and for his wines in particular. Similarly, in France, we have a winemaker called Gérard Bertrand, based down in the Languedoc, who, again, has brought that sort of entrepreneurial, innovative style to the way Languedoc wines are sold and marketed in the UK. You know, we're very pleased to have those guys on board because they pull the whole offer forward and you know, they have a great reputation, and we enjoy that reputation as well.
As an importer of French wines, what are the big changes in France going on at the moment?
Well, I would say one of the biggest changes is a seismic shift in the way many companies in France are doing business. And you've got to remember that France is a huge production. It's 57 million hectolitres of wine compared to Australia's, you know, it's about a fifth of that.
I read somewhere Bordeaux produces more wine than all of Australia.
That's correct. And so you've got a huge production base, and a huge proportion of this production base is owned by farmers, and farmers who basically take the grapes to the local cooperative. What's changing is that there are companies starting to stick their heads up above the parapet in terms of, you know, entrepreneurial, innovative marketing nous, in terms of great value, and in terms of great quality, you know, which is essentially focusing on great quality. And these guys could be cooperatives, like they could be private companies. And we're seeing these businesses driven by young, dynamic individuals who really, really want to get on. And as a result, we're starting to see the whole French wine industry change. And so this is not obviously just having an impact in the UK. It's also having an impact on the way French wines are sold in France itself and around the rest of the world. And those sort of early signs of one of our speakers earlier today described as the green shoots of recovery, the spring buds, that is absolutely fundamental to the French wine offer over the next sort of 15, 20 years. These are the guys who are going to be sitting here in 15, 20 years on top of highly successful businesses that are much bigger than they are today. So I think one of the things that we have to accept is that there is consolidation coming to the French wine industry. And then that will, again, have a big impact on the way we sell and market the wines in the UK. So from a UK perspective, how that impacts, well, what we're seeing is people, businesses, who are taking a real challenge out to perhaps the more sophisticated businesses that we find in Australia and California, that are sort of big worldwide businesses with great marketing teams and, you know, real sort of a real vision of the future. And actually, there are some French companies starting to put their heads up and say, yeah, we want to be amongst these guys.
How do they differentiate themselves from, say, the négociants of Louis Latour or some of the other négociant houses?
Well, I think if you look at the négociant base, it's similar to a cooperative base. You have good and bad in there. And négociants need to find their niche. So, you know, basically a négociant can be a négociant who basically does a lot of volume, cheap prices, and just bungs it onto the market and hopes that'll drive his business. Those guys really are going out of business today. The négociants who are successful fall into two camps, in my view. There's the innovative, marketing-driven négociants, such as Scally, who are basically driving very hard a sort of, you know, whole marketing offer, focusing on brands and all that. And then the other side is people like Louis Latour, who you mentioned, who are very much the sort of traditional premium-end négociants. Louis Jadot is another one in Burgundy. They tend to be focused in the sort of the high-profile regions. And these guys are running very successful businesses. You know, they have a quality focus, but it's very much a traditional, focusing on what's traditional in France. So they're good businesses, but I would say they're perhaps not very entrepreneurial in some ways.
Okay. Tim Atkin said earlier about the new region, or the French wine, as being a good thing, where you can blend a bit of Loire with a bit of Languedoc. What's the name of the new...
Vignoble de France, it's called.
Vignoble de France.
Yeah, which means French vineyards. And that's a great thing, because one of the things that's been very restrictive over the last sort of 20 years or so has been the appellation system, which tends to prohibit cross-regional blending. It prohibits a number of different things, what grape varieties you need, and so on and so forth. And in many cases, it's been a good thing. I mean, Champagne, obviously, is a great appellation in its own right. Chablis, Chazeneuve, you know, in many ways, it's been a good thing. But in some ways also, those appellations that haven't succeeded for, you know, quality reasons, they haven't succeeded because they mean nothing to the consumer. And what Vignoble de France gives an opportunity to a vineyard owner is actually, look, I can blend across regions, I can take the best of the Loire, I can take the best of the Rhone, I can take the best of the south of France, put it all together and actually market that as a brand. And I think we're going to see some very interesting brands coming out in the next couple of years that make life simple for the consumer, that don't complicate things by complicated appellation rules, and we don't really understand what this is. You know, just nice straightforward stuff and drive some big volume. Obviously it gives the flexibility of blending, and you know, we're going to see that more and more, I think.
Is Vin de Noble de France a appellation controller, or is it more like the
Vendepay level?
When did that come in?
I believe that's in force now.
Because I haven't seen anything.
No, I think we'll start to see wines emerging from over the next sort of year or so.
Wine blending is an art in itself, but you do get synergy, you know, where the sum is greater than the sums of the parts.
Exactly. And I think that's right. And I think one of the things that France has always been quite regional, quite insular in some ways. So one of the speakers a bit earlier mentioned that guys in Bordeaux don't drink Burgundy and vice versa. And that's still very much the case. If you go to a restaurant in Bordeaux, you won't, very, very unlikely to find any Burgundy wines on the list. So there's that sort of insularity that really has, you know, in many ways is something that France is proud of, the sort of variety and the diversity and the specialism of each region. And yet it is also a barrier to getting the consumer on board, especially a consumer who doesn't really understand much about wine, perhaps doesn't really want to understand much about wine.
They just want to enjoy it.
They just want to enjoy it. So you know, it's a sign that the French government and the guys who run the appellation control system are basically saying, we need to build more flexibility into this because that's what our consumer is saying. And that's really the first time that powers that be in France have recognized that they have a consumer out there. It tends to be a very production-led industry with a lot of production figures heading it up. And those guys really will always do what's in the best interests of the producer.
Yeah.
And sometimes the consumer doesn't get much of a look in, so they switch off, you know.
Do you think the Americans will consume less French wine? Because they're a fairly big importer of French
wine. Yeah, I would imagine that would be the case. Yeah.
What will happen to that extra wine?
Well, I think the thing is, what you mustn't forget about America, though, is that the per capita consumption is extremely low. So it's a big country, 320 million people, but the per capita consumption is very, very low. So even though we say, they're going to consume less, they're on that growth curve. So, in, you know, temporary blip, maybe year or two, you know, fine. But then things will start to come back. However, I think, you know, you say what happens to that wine. We are currently in a world shortage at the moment.
Which is a bit of a change.
We've come from a surplus very quickly into a shortage. And my latest figures show that we've got about a 9 million hectolitre shortage, which is not dissimilar to the size of the entire Australian wine industry. So if there's that shortage in the pipeline, you know, to be honest, if consumption drops off in a couple of countries, that's probably quite good. And there's a lot of development, obviously, in the Far East, China, India. These markets are in massive growth. And what they call the embric countries, which is basically Mexico, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, these countries are all in massive growth at the moment, from a very small base, admittedly. But I think the per capita consumption of somewhere like Mexico is less than one litre per head. You know, all you need to do is double that, and you've got another, you know, few million cases going, no problem. So.
Does that mean, you know, you talked about this 9 million litre shortage, does that mean that the wine lake in France is now draining?
Sure, straight dried up, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that the point to make is that we obviously have a level of acceptable quality in the UK that the UK consumer simply won't drop below. And sadly, like France, Italy and Spain, these three very, very big producers of wine, they have a lot of stuff out there that just simply isn't drinkable for the UK consumer. So technically speaking, there are wines still available. I mean, you can walk into any wine region in France and buy wine in quantity, but it's whether you'd want to drink it that's the key point. Now, obviously, I don't know exactly what, you know, I can't quantify exactly how much is drinkable and how much is undrinkable, but the fact of the matter is the wine lake of stuff you'd actually want to drink doesn't exist anymore.
Okay.
So, it's definitely dried up.
But there's still excess wine that's been distillation.
Yeah, distillation. But there's a lot of arrachage going on, which is basically the pulling up of the vines. I think we're talking about 15,000 hectares already. You know, so it's a big step forward for countries like France, you know, because it actually balances their supply and demand. And when you balance your supply and demand, it means that the whole offer improves. The consumer gets it, the producer gets it, and everyone's happy.
In your presentation earlier, you talked about the average price of French wines going up.
I think from memory, I'd need to double check my figures, but in the UK average is about £4 and a penny at the moment, and yep. I believe France it's just under £4.50 average, so it's well above the average.
Beginning of this year, there was a lot of talk about prices going up because of this shortage that we've been talking about. Is this price rise in keeping with that shortage, or do you think it's a change in the consumption habits and the price that people are willing to pay?
I think there's a bit of both. I think there's, if you look at the price bands in the UK of French wines versus the total market, 75% is sold under £5. In France, the figure is 61%. So for French wines, if it was 61% sold under £5, which means that there's a huge proportion sold at a premium end. So the problem that many people have in France is that actually it's not that cheap a place to make wine. It has high production costs, high labor costs, and high land costs. And I don't know whether it's ever going to dominate at the very cheap end of the market. My belief is that, you know, with such a huge production, it will continue to have a presence there. But actually what France does best, and what France does best in this market in particular, is stuff over £5. And that's where you get the quality, the diversity, and the heritage that so many consumers are looking for from their French wine offer.
Excellent. I think we're going to wrap it up there, Matthew, but can I just get a couple of recommendations for unusual French wines that people should keep an eye out for?
Okay, that's an interesting one. I would definitely say that the Fitou appellation in the southwest of France, just down by Perpignan, Fitou, is absolutely superb. And the guys down there, which is a company called Montoche, who basically dominate the Fitou appellation, they've really mastered the art of the sort of the ladder. So you can get inexpensive Fitou at just under £4. You can get Fitou at £12. And it's all great stuff. So really, really great value. What else would I say is looking good? I would say that there's some great value in the Rhone at the moment as well. These are wines that perhaps aren't that familiar to the UK consumer, wines like Vacheras, Gigondas. And again, there's some guys down there, Cave Saint-Pierre, who are doing some great stuff around sort of branding their own appellations and some of the little-known appellations to really bring them to the consumer. And again, it's a sort of, you know, concentrating on this heritage, but really great quality stuff at sort of, you know, £5 upwards.
Okay. A wine I've always quite liked, because I think it's just a cheap version of Sancerre, Saint-Brie.
Oh, yeah, Sauvignon Saint-Brie, up in Burgundy.
I've had some wines recently that are just better than most Sancerres
and
cheaper.
And it's interesting because if you look at that, you know, pretty much everything that is grown around there is Chardonnay. And yet there's this one sort of odd appellation, Sauvignon Saint-Brie, that sits doing Sauvignon. And as you say, you know, sort of a good value Sancerre, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, Matthew.
No problems. Cheers, Chris. Thanks.
Next week, we continue looking at France, but we're going to be looking at one of the often missed regions, the Jura. We're going to be talking with Wink Lorch on Jura wines. But before we close, how are you getting on with the quote? I like to have a martini, two at the most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under the host. Well, our writer is famous for her quick quip, is attributed to Dorothy Parker. Bit obscure for some, but not too related to wine, but I really like the quote. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.